Welcome, everyone, to this episode 15 of Christian History and Ideas. We are continuing our discussion of ancient Jerusalem in the late classical period. And we looked in episodes 13 and 14 to the very early days of the church in Jerusalem. And we continue this after Constantine and at the time of Constantine. So that's what this episode number 15 and our colleague episode number 16 will deal with. And one technical note, and that is as loyal viewers and watchers of this series, you know that we are always putting you up to doing some work on your end. As the viewer, we don't want to be mindless consumers. And boy, for episode 13, I give you a little bit of work. One of the projects of Dr. Doss and I is to, you know, kind of become more independent with platforms and things like that. And I made a little a boo-boo, shall we say, with episode 13. So you have to go to Podomatic. And there actually is a file for episode 13, but I just direct you in that to the Podomatic. So the audio is preserved. I made a rookie mistake on some of this new tech. So the audio, the visual part is off in the cloud and the ether in some data center or something. But anyway, we continue our discussion here. And Dr. Doss, I've been gibbering and jabbering here. Welcome.
Oh, great to be here, John. Good to get all that clarified.
Absolutely. And I think we'll just jump right into our topic here. At the end of this recording, of course, we'll mention our own work here with the Apostle and things like that. But Dr. Doss, we left off really at this pivotal moment in episode 14, which, you know, it's really epochal in Christian history. And that is, of course, Constantine. And Nicaea. And maybe a good thing to start off with actually is going to be a psalm that mentions Jerusalem, but then we're going to get into the definition of the city itself and some related concepts that that you would, I think, be very helpful to discern for us. So sacred geography, and also really picking up where we left off, the idea of the Christians reviving the memory of Jerusalem, which indeed, is, if viewers recall, was destroyed after various rebellions and so forth. So with that, let's start off with Psalm 136 in the Septuagint, and that's 137 for all you Masoretic sorts. And this often appears in Vesper. So this psalm is in connotation to Jerusalem and memory. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat weeping when we remembered Zion. On the poplars in its mist, we hung up our harps. For there our captors asked us the words of a song, our tormentors for joy. Sing for us a song of Zion, but how could we sing a song of the Lord in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget, may my tongue stick to my palate if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem beyond all my delight. So that's the selection from Psalm 136 there. And Dr. Doss, maybe we can start off with Jerusalem, which appears so often in the liturgy and in the Bible. What does the name actually signify?
Sure. It's quite a problematic name, actually. People think it's easy to know and understand. They think it means the holy city or something like that. But it's a very difficult word to pin down in history, i.e. the history of the word, or etymology, as we might call it. And there's all kinds of heated discussion among scholars as to what it could possibly mean. But the consensus seems to be that it's a very ancient Canaanite word. And probably related the first part, there's two parts to the word, to the name. There's the Jeru and the Salem. And the Jeru part probably relates to Jericho and various other Palestinian and, Palestine, cities in Palestine and in the area and Syria and so forth. So it's a very problematic word, that part. And the second part is even more problematic as to what it means, the Salem. Interestingly enough, if we go back to the Greek Bible, we have two versions or two spellings or even two names, really. You have the Jerusalem, which we're familiar with. And there's another one which is more common. For example, Paul uses it mostly, and other writers as well, most famously Josephus and all that. That is a very interesting word as well. And yet that's Jerusaluma. Jerusaluma is a very problematic word. And of course, notice how unfamiliar it is to our ears. But in the Greco-Roman world, that was the more familiar version. And the Jerusalem was a kind of foreign sounding word. So some people think it's the Greeks trying to Hellenize a Semitic word. Others think that perhaps it's a better reflection of what it really was. So we don't really know what the original word was that was used. And there, to add to the confusion, the city is also often referred to as just simply Solima. You know, the Jeru is gone. So just the Solima part is often used. And in some ancient texts, the Jews themselves are called Solimites, people who live in Solima, people who are resident in or around the city. So it's a very interesting scenario that we're looking at as far as the history of the word goes. But if we dig a lot, and this is again very problematic, it probably means the jurisdiction, the enclosure of the god Shalem. Shalem is a very ancient Semitic god of the sunset, of the setting sun, of, you know, just evening coming on. And it was a very hieratic kind of a time in the day, in the 24-hour period in the ancient world. So there's the larger consensus is that it means the Jeru probably means jurisdiction, protection, under the protection of, and Shalem probably refers to this god Shalem. This idea that this really means the city of peace is probably a Greek idea, because the Greeks were busy naming their cities with the first part, which is Heros. Hero means sacred. So this precinct of the Greek world colliding with the Jewish is what we're really witnessing. So we have a Semitic remnant of a word on which all kinds of Hellenized meaning has been imposed. And of course, it's the Hellenized meaning that we're all familiar with. So it's a very problematic word, and therefore a very interesting one. But what it really means, it's still up in the air. But the consensus, like I said, is that it's probably related to the word, to the god, the ancient Canaanite god, Shalem, which is, by the way, the word is related to the word peace, Shalom, we are familiar with in Hebrew, for example, Salam in Arabic. So the word is related to these two words, but it refers to the deity, given the ending. The other interesting thing is that in the later Hebrew traditions, the city is referred to as Yerushalayim. The I-M is, of course, a plural, which means, are there two cities? This makes it even more problematic as to where that word comes from. So it's a very interesting etymological problem as to what this is. So I'm just, without drawing any conclusions, because we can't, I'm just throwing all the possibilities out. So we have three possibilities. We have the Greek one, which is, you know, Solomites and all that. Then we have the Hebrew one, Jerusalem. And then we have this Yerushalayim, the third, the plural aspect of, Jerusalem's. There's more than one. So which ones? We don't know.
Now, another concept, and one that really comes to the fore in this time, and once again, we're looking at the 4th century, and this Constantinian and post-Constantinian period, very, very important in church history, of course, for various reasons. And Dr. Das, as we're setting the stage for a real change which happens in perception, another thing we might want to define here is the idea of sacred geography.
Right. Good. Yes, that's a very key point here. And what we need to do is to first define what we mean by sacred geography, and then, of course, apply it to this city and this area known as, for us, the Holy Land. So very briefly, very quickly, when we talk about sacred geography, we're talking about portions of the land, sometimes even the city, that have higher significance than simply location, i.e. it's not simply, you know, a spot on the map, but it has some kind of greater or higher significance. And usually that higher significance is spiritual. Usually that means that if you visit this place or go to this place, you will incur some kind of blessing upon yourself, and even spiritual guidance or healing, all these qualities that are vested with certain kinds of places. And why these certain kinds of places have this kind of ability to touch humanity in a certain way is because some holy action or some holy person inhabited that space. So by way of holy action or by way of a holy person, the place itself somehow absorbs the sanctity that was created there, either through the witness of the person living there or the witness of the action, the holy action that was done there. And that absorption of sacred energy, for lack of a better term, that absorption of sanctity allows this place to then dispense this sanctity to those that come and visit. Not that the sanctity is, of course, some kind of thing, something inherent in the land itself, but the sanctity is a reflection of what had happened there before through the person, say a saint, or you know, through a saint's action or through some holy action. So when we're talking about sacred geography, we shouldn't get confused with a pagan concept of holy places. We have to keep this separate. The pagan concept of holy places, where the earth itself has certain energies that need to be harnessed by way of ritual or by way of religious ceremony or something like that, and it's the, you know, the ground itself or the sacred water itself that you know, hands out the benedictions or the blessings. In the Christian context, this is not what we're talking about. We're not talking about the earth inherently possessing energies that need to be channeled for our benefit. What we're really talking about is that the place itself becomes a motivation for meditation, where once we go there, we meditate in imitation of the sacred act, in imitation of the sacred person that happened or inhabited that place. And that's what that becomes. So it's an evocation of holiness for Christian pilgrimage to holy places, an evocation. And whatever miracles happen there are not because of the spot itself, but rather of what happened there and the evocation of that event or that action or that person. So we have to keep the two separate. I don't know if that's being, if I'm, you know, being clear or not, or muddying the things further, but we have to clarify this thing. So not inherent energy in the earth, which is the pagan concept of holy places, but rather holy action done on a certain spot. Visions or holy acts, courage, martyrdom, all these kinds of things that are associated in history, but then that lead us out of the place itself into reflection or meditation upon faith itself. So we have to keep the two separate. We often, unfortunately, in poorly thought out anthropological scholarly studies, so-called scholarly studies, there's a huge confusion between the two. Just because Christians go to a place, oh, it's just like, you know, some pagans going to their place, you know, like going to Delphi or something like that. It isn't going to Delphi. And we'll get into that with the pilgrimage thing. This is why I'm building this up to our segue to pilgrimage. So the Christian journey is to a place is different from a pagan journey to a place, even though to a uninitiated eye, the two seem to be the same, but they're not, because there's a very deep qualitative difference between the two actions. And we can talk about that in our discussion with pilgrimage.
And as we're building up, we remember from our study of the early church, we'll say the ante-Nicene days, that certain of the church fathers, in order to emphasize that distinction, actually were quite insistent that Jerusalem had no significance whatsoever in order to, again, make that demarcation and to avoid that confusion. But we're watching now as the generations pass, we're getting into the fourth century indeed, that this idea of pilgrimage is also coming back with the fine clarifications made and so forth. Dr. Das, can we talk about now, at this time, the role that the Christians play in reviving the memory of Jerusalem after these traumatic wars and dispossessions and the diaspora and this sort of thing, and then Rome's attempt to truly erase Jerusalem and doing things including renaming it, always interesting, the battle over names and language. What is the role that the Christians play in reviving the city of Jerusalem in various ways, in memory and in structure, we'll say?
Sure, yes, yeah, especially in structure as well. Architecture is a very interesting, but we can talk about that some other time. But very briefly, it's a very interesting question as to how it is that Jerusalem again recovers its sanctity, as it were. So what's going on with this? What happens is that when Jerusalem becomes Aelina Capitolina, the Roman city, and it remains that for the longest time. I mean, in Arabic, it comes down as Ilia, the memory is there. Capitolinas is how it's remembered in Alexandrian documents and some other Syriac documents, i.e. the name Jerusalem is basically forgotten outside the context of scripture. It is not really regarded as something outside the spiritual landscape, i.e. there is no physical spot that you can go to. Not that people have forgotten what this is all about, not at all, but rather, as you have mentioned well in the beginning, is that the emphasis of sanctity is no longer located in geography itself at this time, i.e. you don't need a physical Jerusalem in order to make Christianity work. And this was the problem with the Second Temple Judaism, for example. It needed a temple in order to make itself work. Once the temple disappears, the rug's pulled out from under Second Temple Jerusalem, and they have to rebuild. And that's a different trajectory we can get into. So what happens is that when Constantine becomes the emperor, he becomes emperor in 306 AD. He becomes emperor in 306 AD. And of course, as we know, he's a Christian by this time, even though he's baptized much later. But he is a professing Christian as such. What he does is that he, and we think this is how it progresses to that end, he appoints his mother as the person who is going to go and preserve the history of Christianity. And so this idea that Christianity's relationship to history needs to be documented and preserved and cataloged and all that sort of thing. It's a scholarly attempt, by the way. This is the first Christian scholarship, as it were, in a way, dealing with history and so forth. We need to do something about it, he thinks. And he appoints his mother as the person best able to handle this, which, of course, means a lot. And we can get into that later as to the person and character of Constantine's mother, Saint Helena. And she then takes on this role and sets out doing what she does. And it's in, I think, 326, about 20 years later, after her son becomes emperor. In 326, she sets out to Palestine to find Christian history, or rather to relocate what has happened in the life of Jesus within the geography in which he lived. Jesus is now being historicized, placed in history, as opposed to simply, or not simply, but solely being divine. So this academic concern for Christianity, and it really is an academic because, this is part of the very great Constantinian library. This project is going to be, which was extensive, far more than Alexandria. She heads out in 326, and of course does what she does. She rebuilds some churches, like the Church of the Nativity, relocates various holy sites, but most importantly, and we will get to that, she discovers the true cross. It's going to be the hallmark event of her journey. Her journey lasts 2 years. She's back in 328, she has by this time codified this concept of Jerusalem as deeply connected with Christian history. And here we have to be very careful, because this is something that we are in the habit of doing, given the way we think modernly. And that is that when we're talking about Christian history, Helena and Constantine and all the Christians in this area are not separating themselves into Old Testament and New Testament, right? They're not saying, oh, that was all Hebrew stuff and this is now us. This is not what they're doing. So for them, Christian history is Genesis onwards. So we have to keep that in mind when we're talking about this concept of relocating Jerusalem. So they're not going back and relocating a Judaic city. They're going back and relocating a Christian one right back to its origins, i.e. Genesis onwards. So it's a Christian project in their minds. Whether we get, huff about it or not, that's a different matter. For them, when they're doing this, when they're undertaking or relocating sacred geography, sacred Christian geography, they really mean it in the sense that, if Christ is God, then of course he's there in the beginning too. He's not going to be showing up in the first century and that's that. That concept of extension, both forward but more importantly backward into history, is key here. And interestingly enough, it's Helena that begins this consciousness. So we're talking about a very interesting consciousness that's going to be developing here. When Jerusalem becomes holy again, it's interesting that at this time a very interesting word pops up Greek literature, in Christian literature, and that is the hagiopolite, or the hagiopolity. And hagiopolity, H-A-G-I-O-P-O-L-I-T-E, quickly means the sacred city, and it refers to Jerusalem. So when they talk about the hagiopolity in this context, it means that the sacredness has been now replaced or rediscovered, or whatever we may want to say, back into the city of Jerusalem, i.e. Jerusalem has been renamed as a Christian place. And only later it will become a source of contention. But at this time, it's firmly a Christian discovery, a Christian naming process, and a Christian advocacy of what this place is. And so as a hagiopolitical function, Jerusalem then becomes part of Christian consciousness as to what happened there. And that Christian consciousness means in this context is that certain places within the world have very strict connotations to what happened in Christian history. So this idea of Christian history now is starting to emerge. And it emerges, like I said, with St. Helena. We can go on and on about this, but very briefly, what this then means is that this idea that since there are places that are associated with the life of Jesus, still relevant and observable in this world, is going to lead to the next step, which is pilgrimage, i.e. let's go see this, etc. And very briefly, as a footnote, this is also then going to become part of the crusading, the crusades, the crusading impetus that is going to come about 1,000 years, well, less than 1,000 years later, about 700 years later, from all of this time.
So let us indeed, perhaps as we shift to people like Igeria, who leaves us a monograph of sorts, or the Bordeaux itinerary, well, maybe we can define the word pilgrim, Dr. Das, in order to not just define it, but also ascertain its development and how it shifted its meaning from the classical world into the Christian world. Because it is like many churchy words originally has an earlier workaday meaning. Basilica comes to mind in that regard. Which was a courtroom, basically, or something of that effect, an official building. And pilgrim has a similar type of earlier meaning. But I must say, if we can have some fun here, do you have in Canada Bible-themed Holy Land?
Oh, you mean like parks and things? Parks,
yeah, like theme parks.
I don't think so, but it might well be one. I'm not sure.
I didn't think so either. We have these things in America, including Connecticut. People who used to take Route 84, they would see a big cross, very, very heartening, actually, on the hill there. And that was from an amusement park called the Holy Land in Waterbury, Connecticut. But before Connecticut got to it, before America started making Bible amusement parks, the tradition is much older. And let us talk about, indeed, the idea of pilgrim and pilgrimage before we get into Igeria and the itinerary.
Sure, yes. The word itself, as we know, it comes from the Latin peregrinatus, and which means to wander around, walking around. The idea of pilgrimage or pilgrim, i.e. someone who undertakes a sacred vow to go visit a holy place in order to, benefit from it spiritually. Again, as a footnote, this undercuts that entire narrative of the Crusades as somehow being colonialism, going and robbing people and all that sort of thing. But anyway, that's a different matter. So pilgrimage at this very early time means let's go see what St. Helena has revealed to us. So when St. Helena finishes her job of relocating the sanctity of what we now call the Holy Land or Jerusalem at this time, because, Jerusalem is the center here in this regard, when she reinvests Jerusalem with sacred qualities or sacred meaning, of course, this becomes immediately knowable throughout the Roman Empire. And it's interesting that, you know, we will look at this later. You mentioned Nigeria. And it's interesting that these people come from far and abroad, I mean, far and wide. They're not like just, you know, down the road there. They come from long, long places far away to Jerusalem for their pilgrimage. But how pilgrims becomes a simple word for someone who wanders around a lot to someone who takes a sacred vow to visit holy places or a holy place comes about at this time, as I suggested. Why? Because what this means is that it becomes part of that concept of abandonment of the world, that process of not being so vested with worldly things that you don't have time for holiness, for the sanctity, for you know, sacred work, holy work. Let's put it that way. So this idea of relegating some of your life on this earth to work that is holy, as opposed to simply work that is selfish and looking after yourself all the time, becomes part of this idea that becomes part of worship, let's put it this way, becomes part of Christian worship. That one way to do this is, okay, you can go to church and do all that, go to Mass and, you know, what all those other, participate in sacraments. But the other way is to participate in holy work. And one, of course, way, there's all kinds of, you know, other things like charity and all that, but one aspect of this holy work is to walk, and not simply to, you know, take a plane and go there quickly, but somehow undertake a difficult journey, something that will challenge you bodily, physically, as well as, of course, emotionally and spiritually, therefore. But something that will challenge you and something that will demand more of you than simply comfort. So you will have to pay your own way. You will have to make sure you arrange everything so wherever you end up, you'll have a place to sleep or not, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an entire logistics behind this holy work. It's not simply, and you can guess where all this, you know, travel industry is going to be popping up soon. at this time, sacred pilgrimage, the word is used, it's a common word for walking about, for wanderers. So you become a holy wanderer. And of course, it has certain kinds of implications and demands on you, i.e. it must be difficult. You've got to walk, usually. You have to pay your own way. You have to take, you know, vows of chastity and poverty. You can't be partying it up every time, you know, you go there and et cetera, and pretend that you're going on a village, you know, pilgrimage, et cetera. So there's all kinds of demands on you. So it becomes part of this a physical attribute of holy work. So prayer may be holy work, but so is walking to something. And here you will have, you know, extremists who will go on their knees or crawl and all that sort of thing. You know, you have that kind of, you know, beginning of that sort of behavior among people who want to really show their, you know, their devotion to how holy and how difficult this place, this thing is. So this idea of holy work becomes incorporated into this notion of wandering, which is a very Hellenic one, you know, wandering about and so forth. And because you have also taken vows of chastity and poverty, that means you will probably be begging for food along the way, because, you know, you will have limited resources and it's a long way to Jerusalem from wherever you are. And you're going to be walking out on foot one day, and it'll be a while before you come back. If you come back, there's a lot of stories of people getting killed halfway there. So anyway, this idea of pilgrimage becomes lifted into holiness by this association of it to sacred or holy work, where this is part of sacred obligation, sacred worship, sacred duty, and so forth. And it has spiritual recompense. It's not simply if you just do it and say, oh, well, good job, but, you know, you bought a t-shirt and you know, come back. But it's something more than that. It has, spiritual significance for you. And of course, soon the church is going to get into this notion wholeheartedly and endorse it through its own institutional endorsements, for lack of a better term, where if you do this, you know, there's all kinds of things that can happen, benefits that can accrue from sacred journeys undertaken. So the journey to Jerusalem is the very first, for Christians, sacred journey that they can undertake. And this happens very early on, as we will look at in a bit.
And we will, in our next episode, look at the liturgy, the influence of Jerusalem and the Jerusalem liturgy on the larger church in centuries subsequent. But, you know, that's an excellent point you make, Dr. Das, about the, you know, at this time in church history, there wasn't that strict delineation between Old Testament and New Testament. And so, you know, the early Christians, they would see things like a journey to Jerusalem very much in the tradition of the Hebrews and their own history. Of course, the journey from Egypt into Palestine, the journey back from captivities. And indeed, even in the Hebraic liturgy, the Old Testament liturgy, if I can use that language, you know, there were even memorials for the Hebrews to remember their time journeying, such as the Feast of Tabernacles, where they would have to, you know, set up tents almost, or you know, little huts to remind themselves of previous journeys. So there's such a rich history that the Christians are really building off of from the Hebrews. And perhaps we can, in this last section here, introduce one of our primary sources, Dr. Das, and that is Egeria.
Yes, and Egeria, very quickly, is a very mysterious person. we don't really even know her name. We know her name, before, you know, let's cut to the chase. She is one of the earliest and the first women pilgrims to Jerusalem. Certainly the very first woman pilgrim. She's not the first pilgrim. The first is another one. Some mysterious guy from Bordeaux who goes in 333 AD to Jerusalem. So, and Egeria, a woman, goes to Jerusalem around the 380s. So about 50 years after. But why Egeria is important is because of the great detail she gives us. And it's a very, very impressive set of details that she gives us about her journey, but also about Jerusalem itself. So her itinerary to Jerusalem, or her pilgrimage to Jerusalem, tells us that from a very early time, and the pilgrim from Bordeaux tells us the same thing, that from a very early date, we have a very strong tradition of people walking to Jerusalem, and walking not simply to go and see the sites, but as a pilgrimage, i.e. a sacred holy work, which has sacred holy benefits to the person doing it. So this idea of pilgrimage, of undertaking a journey to a holy spot, we see by these two accounts, very early accounts, that it has very firmly established itself. This practice has very firmly established itself. And these people are from far away. The pilgrim from Bordeaux is from Bordeaux, France. And Egeria, there's a bit of controversy as to where she's from, but likely Spain or probably France as well, because she mentions the Rhone River. And because she mentions the Rhone River, we think it's France. But anyway, regardless of where she's from, she's going there it's a very long journey. And it's a journey that will take, at least 2 years, 3 years maybe even. So that means you have to have your logistics down really well, because you're going to be traveling to places you've never been to. And you will have to rely on, institutions, establishments to look after yourself. And the other interesting thing is, of course, the languages. fortunately, by this time, Latin is universal. And so you can have a universal language, exactly, that can help you along in your journey. So you're not a total stranger where, you know, you can't communicate to anybody. But you do have Latin and everyone speaks Latin. And that is the common thread here, which we can get into some other time, the Latinity and Latin and Christianity. What Egeria is important for, and quite interesting as well, is that she goes and is a very keen observer. She makes detailed records. She leaves detailed records of what she sees in all these holy places. She meets very interesting people. She records conversations. And she does it in a journalistic style. She's one of the first, I think, Christian journalists. In my mind as well. Because why is she writing this report or this itinerary? Well, like I gave it away, it's a report back to her friends back in France or wherever she's from, you know, back in the Rhone Valley, let's say that. She's also doing journalistic work. She's been sent out perhaps by a bunch of people who may have financed her. And now she's, you know, meeting that obligation by reporting back and telling them all the stuff that they wanted to know. And it's likely, given her itinerary, that she probably came along with a whole bunch of questions that these people had. So they probably sat down and read the Bible very carefully, came up with all these interesting geographical questions. For example, she says, sadly, I couldn't locate the Pillar of Salt. When she went to the Dead Sea, even though she looks everywhere. And she says, no, I can't find it. But people tell me that it's probably the seawater has now covered it up. So, you know, you can tell that this is probably something on the list. Go see salt, you know, the salt, the Pillar of Salt. And can you see Lot's wife, you know, as a Pillar of Salt, that sort of thing. So she's reporting back to her friends back in the Rhone Valley. So it's a very interesting document that way, and a very human document in that regard. It's one that is filled with curiosity, filled with wonder, and of course, filled with holiness as well, because she encounters holiness and her reactions to it. So it's a very interesting document that I think people should get familiar with a lot more and read, actually. And I think the best translation is by Wilkinson. It came out in the early 1900s. But anyway, the interesting
name of that document, if people want to look up that autograph, what is the name of that?
I'm sorry?
The name of Egeria's document. What would it be published on, do you think?
Oh, it's called The Itinerary of Egeria. Yeah.
Excellent.
And that's the title of the book. Yeah, let's put it that way. The translation. And let's just say there's a translation. And people should read it. It's a very fun document. And it's the first travel literature. You know, it's the beginning of travel literature as well. So, you know, there's all kinds of ramifications greater than spiritual as well, culturally. Because, like I said, this is the first journalistic attempt, someone being sent out and saying, okay, go find out about all this stuff and then report back to us. So she's writing back as a journalist. It's travel literature. It's explorative literature, i.e. going to some strange new place and finding out everything you can, and so forth. It's a very interesting document that way.
I think this is a good place to wind down this first half of the third part of this discussion, the second half of this post-Constantinian discussion, however we want to demarcate things. But when we continue in episode 15, we're going to get into some things like, and in addition to other things, the Bordeaux itinerary, maps, monasticism, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, the Jerusalem liturgy and how that itself incorporates a pilgrimage within those ceremonies and such, particularly around Holy Week. Dr. Das, before we fly for this episode, tell us a bit about the Apostol for this month. What are some articles we can enrich ourselves with?
Sure. We have a really interesting issue for October, and I encourage people to go and have a look. But some of the highlights, that are, I think, very, people will find very interesting are... discussions about about what it means to understand history, discussions about literature, and discussions about politics. There's quite a few interesting concepts of what this is. And one of the new things that we're trying to explore in this issue is this idea of military history, which is a very interesting concept and very little discussed and known for some reason. So this is something that we've started exploring as to what this means. What is this idea of military history? I think people will find that quite interesting.
Excellent. And regarding apostasis, I would only say that if anyone is in a creative mood this semester and you have poetry, prose, fiction, nonfiction, drawings, what have you, once you're done submitting to the postal, I'm sure Dr. Dodds is happy to receive submission from time to time. Submit to Apocalypsis Institute at AOL.com. And the theme this semester is love and hate, and is broad, but anything that you think is appropriate to that topic, I welcome for the journal. And then lastly, for people interested in this series, perhaps you have some commentary, some correspondence you'd like to send our way, maybe a show tip, or even an offer to participate in a discussion on a topic that you're especially well-versed on related to Christian history and ideas. All of this, you may write Dr. Doss and myself at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. And with that, Dr. Doss, thank you so much for your expertise this episode.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure to be here.